Good morning and welcome to Beyond the Headlines on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Yunji Huang, with my co-host, Elena Villabona Paromero. Beyond the Headlines is a weekly current affairs show that aims to make discussions more accessible to you. We take you beyond the headlines of our daily news, bringing you access to current leaders through in-depth interviews. You can join us in the conversation by tweeting at beyond_headlines. That's BYOND_headlines. Trigger warning. This episode includes content dealing with upsetting, sensitive, and potentially triggering themes, including sexual violence, torture, and death. The Japanese military sexual slavery, known as the Comfort Woman history, refers to the system of sexual slavery by the Imperial Japanese Army during World War II. From 1931 and 1945, between 50,000 and 200,000 girls and women across the Asia-Pacific were forced into sexual servitude. Despite the history having gained international attention, as survivors came forward to share their stories, it remains largely unknown and silenced. Regardless, survivors and human rights activists have fought to raise awareness and have demanded appropriate redress, aiming not only for future generations to be accurately educated about this dark history, but also so that this crime against humanity is not repeated. In the first segment, Woo Hee Kim will provide the audience with a comprehensive understanding of the Comfort Woman issue, exploring its historical background during World War II and addressing the current challenges faced by the survivors. We then delve into what it means to appropriately address this issue and promote reconciliation. In the second segment, Phyllis Kim also explores the significance of the peace monuments in raising awareness around the Comfort Woman issue and provides insights into the activist journey of Grandmother Yeong-su. We finish with Miki Dezaki, who helps us in debunking the Comfort Woman issue being dismissed as solely a political and emotional topic. He explores the significance of the silencing and denialism of such history and how we can overcome these challenges and achieve resolution and reconciliation through informed and respectful discourse. Today, we're honored to welcome Woo Hee Kim, a distinguished guest who works at the intersections of activism, remembrance, and education on the Japanese military sexual slavery issue. As a scholar activist, she delves into the complexities of this issue, drawing from her extensive research and experience. From studying Korean youth activism with the Davis Foundation Projects for Peace grant to her current research on transnational youth activism supported by Harvard University Asia Center, Woo Hee brings a unique perspective shaped by both academic rigor and hands-on involvement in the movement for justice.
Thank you for being here. Can you provide our audience with an understanding of the Comfort Woman issue?
Sure. The short answer would be that the Japanese military comfort women refer to numerous women who were forced into sexual slavery by the Japanese military from 1932 to 1945. And most of women were from regions that were colonized or occupied by Japan at the time, including Korea, Taiwan, the Philippines, China, Indonesia, Malaysia, East Timor, and then there were also women from the Netherlands and Japan. These women were subject to brutal sexual violence, physical abuse, torture, other atrocities at comfort stations that were established throughout the battlefields of the Asia-Pacific War. To also give a little bit of history around comfort stations, we know that the first comfort station was established in 1932 by the Japanese Army in Shanghai, and the Japanese military further expanded comfort stations after they received international criticism for the atrocities that they committed during the Nanjing Massacre in 1937. So these comfort stations were very systematically established by the Japanese military. The Japanese government and military were involved in really the entire creation of the system, from recruiting and boarding the women to establishing and managing comfort stations, both directly and indirectly. And there was a lot of masculinist notions that they used to justify the system in normalizing male sexual desire and portraying women as sexual objects. With that history, one thing that I'll try to emphasize as sort of an ending note is that it's also, I think, really important to think about this history and the survivor stories in intersectional ways. So the military sexual slavery system itself sort of was sort of created at the intersections of colonialism, sort of Japan's colonial power and their imperialist war of aggression, and also patriarchy and gender hierarchies and sexism, obviously. The women who were victimized by the system were often low-income women from marginalized backgrounds in places that were colonized or occupied by Japan. And they were often kidnapped or forced or lured through fraudulent promises of job prospects. The women who were forced into the Japanese military sexual slavery system were also, their experiences were impacted by the intersecting systems of oppression of gender and class and nationality and so forth. So I think it's really important to think about this history from an intersectional lens that takes into consideration how these colonialist, sexist, patriarchal systems came together in creation of the system.
Well, thank you. It was really detailed, and I like that you emphasized the intersectional lens. I think it's really important. Our next question, what is the current situation of the comfort woman, and why is there a lack of global understanding around this topic?
The Japanese military sexual slavery issue is not just a long forgotten chapter of sexual violence in the history of World War II. I think it's also important to recognize that it's also a chapter that has been rewritten by survivors who have come forward to courageously testify about their experiences, broken a long-standing silence, in doing so helped raise a global awareness of women's rights. So a little bit of a history backdrop again. After Japan was defeated in the Second World War, the Japanese military sexual slavery system was pretty much silenced for almost five decades. And there's a number of elements that played into that. For one thing, comfort women were killed or abandoned in battlefields far away from their home. The Japanese had burned and destroyed a lot of documents that have evidence to their war crimes. But also importantly, the few survivors who were able to return to their homelands faced a lot of social stigma around survivors of sexual violence. And the Japanese military sexual slavery system wasn't properly addressed in tribunals that took place after World War II because of Cold War geopolitical interests, where Japan was positioned as an important anti-communist ally for the United States. So the Japanese military sexual slavery issue was really silenced and forgotten for almost five decades until on August 14th, 1991, Kim Hak-sun came forward as the first survivor to publicly testify about her experiences. I think the silence provides an important context for understanding the need for more awareness and education on the issue, but I think it's also very important for us to remember how survivors really broke that silence through their courageous testimony, and how the courageous coming forward of Kim Hak-sun really sparked other survivors all over the world to forward as well and forge a global movement for justice and redress. In forging a transnational movement, the survivors have demanded seven things, which are first for the Japanese government to admit that the military sexual slavery system was a war crime, two, to disclose documents held by the Japanese government on the issue, the history, three, to deliver an official apology, four, to pay legal reparations, five, to punish those who are responsible, six, to educate the history and history textbooks, and seven, to erect a monument and build an archive. So those were the seven demands of the survivors who were calling for justice and redress, but also remembrance so that future generations won't have to experience the kinds of sexual violence that they had to. So you also asked about the current situation of the comfort women. Many of the comfort women survivors are now in their 90s. And are very old. In some countries like Taiwan, survivors who have come forward have all passed away. And among the 240 survivors who officially registered to the Korean government, I believe there's only 9 survivors remaining with us today. So survivors have, for the past 30 plus years, called for redress, for justice, for a peaceful world without war and sexual violence. But the Japanese government has not met survivors' demands for official apologies and legal reparation. What I think is really problematic is that the Japanese government is actively also trying to erase the history by pressuring the removal of Statue of Peace from different parts of the world. And the Statue of Peace is a statue that commemorates the history and survivors' activism that is now built across, I believe, 30 plus locations around the world and more than 100 locations within South Korea. And the last thing that I wanted to say was that there's also and alt-right history denialism on the issue, where history denialists are trying to deny the history and even defame survivors, calling them fake. So that's also very troubling as well to think about. I think that all lends even more to the importance of remembering the survivors' stories and their voices for justice.
Thank you so much. Many of our listeners are unfamiliar with the term comfort woman. How can individuals approach the use of this term with sensitivity to avoid perpetuating stereotypes or unintentionally downplaying the severity of these women's experiences?
Yeah, this is a really important question. Thank you for asking. Comfort women was a term used by the Japanese military as a euphemism to refer to women who were forced into the military sexual slavery system. So we use quotations around the term comfort women to denote that this was a term historically used by the Japanese military. I think it's also important to point out how the term embodies masculinist sort of notions as well, the idea that women are given comfort. Back in the early 90s, when people were first starting to learn about the existence of Japanese military sexual slavery system, there were a mixture of terminology used. And so in 1993, survivors and advocates met at the Second Asian Solidarity Conference. It's a series of conferences that were held where survivors and advocates from the Asia-Pacific region convened to discuss their advocacy work around the Japanese military sexual slavery issue. So in the 1993 Second Asian Solidarity Conference, they discussed what terminology they should use to refer to the system. And they ended up deciding to use military sexual slavery by Japan or Japanese military sexual slavery to refer to the system to accurately sort of reflect the realities of the violence that happened in the system, and Japanese military comfort women to refer to the victims. One thing that I'll also say is that sometimes survivors are also referred to as paimoni in Korean or ama in Taiwan or lola in the Philippines, which I believe are all a way of addressing an elderly woman figure or grandma figure. And so that I think is also really interesting. It sort of shows the affectionate ways in which intergenerational movement for justice has also understood survivors as a grandma figure, and in that way sort of tried to also honor voices. So yeah, I'll stop there.
Thank you so much, and also for talking about the other ways we refer to them, and reminded me of the Statue of Peace in front of the embassy in Seoul, and how in winter she has scarves and hats, and it just shows how supporters care for them a lot. I think that's very important.
That's actually such a great point. There's a lot of affection and care that is, in some ways, intergenerational cares, care that survivors show for the younger generations when they talk about how they are doing this fear activism because they don't want the younger generation to suffer in the ways that they did. They want the younger generation to live through a future that is more just, where people aren't subjected to violence, right? Where there's peace. And then there's also sort of the care that the younger generations show towards the survivors and thinking of them as grandma figures and thinking of the statue as an endearing figure of sorts.
Finally, given your expertise in the intersections of education, knowledge, power, and resistance, how would you advise students to approach the comfort woman issue? And what vision do you have for the future of addressing these challenges within educational spaces?
I am a PhD student in education, doing research on youth activism broadly and specifically youth activism on this issue. And I have also myself been involved in this movement for a number of years across borders. So I think a lot about what it means to remember the Japanese military sexual slavery history and why it's important to bear witness and to listen to and honor survivors' stories. So I think thinking about remembrance and education in all this is so important, especially given how the young generation now are the people who can continue to build and share collective memory even after survivors pass away. And in my own sort of research work, I notice people come into the movement with a spark that speaks to them, whether it be about wanting to learn more about their diasporic identities and histories, or wanting to join the fight against sexual violence, both past and present, or wanting to learn more about a long forgotten and often long silenced chapter in history. So all these different elements spark young people's interest in learning more about the history and joining the fight for justice. But what I also noticed that I think is really interesting is how these activists then sort of start to develop an intersectional lens while being involved in the movement for justice that helps them attend to the complexities of the issues that they're fighting for and develop an understanding of the intersectional justices and systems of oppression at play. I think that's really important in thinking about approaching the comfort women issue, the Japanese military sexual slavery issue, in that the vision of justice that this movement and survivors have been building towards is one that connects the Japanese military sexual slavery issue to ongoing sexual violence in today's world, ongoing fights for decolonization, etc., all these connected issues of injustice that we see in today's world. And I would love for people to be able to find those connections and build a movement that not only thinks about remembering the past, but also then thinks about how then it's connected to the present and the future. And I think there's so much to learn from the ways in which transnational youth activists who are working on this issue are engaging in educational efforts already in highlighting both the history as well as survivor stories and their activism and their voices and the waves that they were able to make through their movement. And one last sort of thing that I'll say as an important lesson for educators who might be thinking about how to teach this history is to imagine and move towards a more just future. We need to reckon with the past injustices, and base the ways in which they are connected to the present and manifest in the present. I think that's really important to keep in mind as we think about how we want to educate and remember this issue.
Once again, that was Woo-hee Kim, who joined Elena for a discussion on the comfort woman issue. As our second guest, we're honored to have a passionate advocate and dedicated leader with us, Phyllis Kim, who serves as the Executive Director of Comfort Woman Action for Redress and Education, also known as CARE. Phyllis and her organization have been pivotal in raising awareness about the comfort woman issue stemming from the Pacific War and World War II. CARE played a crucial role in the 2007 campaign to pass U.S. House Resolution 121 and erected the first Statue of Peace in the United States in 2013. Facing challenges head-on, Phyllis fought a lawsuit to protect the Glendale statue and has continued leading campaigns, including collaborating on the San Francisco Comfort Woman Memorial.
Thank you for joining us, Phyllis. First of all, there have been actions on the international level and by the Japanese government to settle the comfort woman issue. Could you please provide your insight on these?
I think we really need to delve into the concept of what is necessary to come to a reconciliation, and if it is possible when certain requirements are met. So we're talking about grave human rights violation, and this was huge scale, and there are tens to hundreds of thousands of survivors. And, you know, this has become an international issue, not just because of the a large number of victims, but also because of the various nationalities of the victims. And I don't know if you ever saw the map of the comfort stations where they were located. It exactly coincided with the occupied territories by the Imperial Japan. And wherever there were troops stations, there were comfort stations. So many women from different countries like the Philippines, Indonesia, and East Timor, Burma, Thailand, India, all these regions, there were comfort stations, and the women were forced into the sexual slavery locally as well. So the international community, like the UN, have been involved and they have looked into this issue since 1990s. And there are two reports by the human rights rapporteurs in the 1990s, one in 1996, another in 1998, and they defined the comfort women issue as institutionalized military sexual slavery. And they defined it as a war crime and crime against humanity committed by a government for the purpose of war. So this is not just some crimes, individual crimes that were committed to a group of women that could be resolved in some other ways, but they, human rights rapporteurs, specifically made recommendations. Six recommendations for the perpetrator government to resolve this issue truthfully. And they are official apology, acknowledgement, and full investigation into the issue, you know, and of course, a legal compensation and the ongoing education. And after the investigation, of course, there will be people who should be responsible for this crime and they should be punished. So they are the six standards by which this comfort women issue can be resolved. And that is exactly what the victims have been demanding from the Japanese government. If you think about these six standards, the first standard is to acknowledge, the Japanese government should acknowledge that this was a war crime and crime against humanity committed by the government. Japanese government still, to this day, deny that Japanese government is responsible for this human rights violation. The Asian Women's Fund was the money raised from the citizens and private corporations. That was exactly to evade the responsibility of the Japanese government. In 2015 agreement, although Japanese government gave money to the foundation in Korea, it specifically denied that this was a legal compensation. It was just assistance. It's like a charity that government donates to other country or victims of a natural disaster. So it's very tricky. And that's exactly what Japanese government has been doing. I think 2015 agreement was another insult, another salt on the wounds for the victims that they could not accept, because even though Japanese government donated money, it was a hush money and it was even more insult for the victims. So of course, some victims, you know, they have financial hardship, they are sick, they need money, and they could receive the money because it was a money to assist these victims. But that does not mean that the issue has resolved because of this 2015 agreement, because basically the Japanese government does not acknowledge. And the proof of that is that last year, UN International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, they have country review every few years. And last year was Japan's turn. This body of UN mentioned the comfort women issue in their report. The committee notes the information provided by the state party regarding its efforts towards addressing human rights violations against comfort women. It regrets that the state party has made no progress with regard to the committee's previous recommendations and continues to deny its obligation under the covenant to address the continuing violation of the victims' human rights. And it reiterates those international standards, you know, how Japanese government can resolve this issue truthfully. And it's same thing over and over again. And it's 7 years after the 2015 agreement and UN's human rights body is still issuing such report. This is testament that how the comfort women issue has never been resolved by the efforts of the Japanese government. So I really think that we have to understand that this kind of human rights violation is being repeated only because the state party has not been held accountable, not even once. And Japan must do it. And we have to continue to tell Japan that no, it has not been resolved because you have not acknowledged the legal responsibility and has not taken actions. Even after all the victims passes away, you have to take responsibility. I think that's what we need to continue to say.
About the 2015 agreement, I think it really showed that the Japanese government wasn't willing to take responsibility just by the fact that they asked for the removal of the Statue of Peace in front of the embassy. It's because right. They don't want to be reminded of that and they want to completely forget. And that just means they're not taking responsibility. And they didn't include the woman in the agreement just shows the extent of their denial. So I think it's very problematic.
You're exactly right.
The Statue of Peace monuments have been installed around the world, and I understand that UN Care were involved in the installation of the peace monument in Glendale. Could you explain to our audience the significance of these monuments and how they have been received both domestically and internationally?
So from the very beginning, we wanted the community to understand that this was not a Korea-Japan bilateral issue. It's an issue much bigger than that. It was a human rights issue. It was an international women's issue. So we made sure to inscribe all the names of the countries from which the women were victimized. So we included Korea, Japan, China, Taiwan, Burma, Thailand, you know, Indonesia, the Philippines, East Timor, and more, of course. And we also wanted to use that opportunity to establish the Comfort Women statue in Glendale as a way to educate the community. So we reached out to different communities. We worked with the Japanese American community from the beginning. So Japanese American community who support the Comfort Women issue came and they supported it whenever at the unveiling, as well as in different hearings, and when Glendale was sued by the Japanese Americans to remove the monument, Japanese American community, as well as all different communities came together to support city of Glendale in the lawsuit. So I think it's really these statues promote understanding of this very important human rights issue in the community. And because the statues are permanent, it's really a symbol to tell the story of what happened in the past. And art speaks 1,000 words. So people can take away different feelings from the statue and they can read the inscription. They can read the explanation of the symbolism. And it is a very calm way of teaching difficult history to all population, including children. The effort building of the monuments around the globe have contributed significantly to raise awareness about this issue in their own community. And it's evolving into solidarity between the local community in acknowledgement that this is not unique anecdotal episode that only happened once in human history, but it's being repeated over and over again. Even before Comfort Women existed, there were systematic violence against women during wartime, and there are ongoing systematic sexual violence against women during war. Wherever there is war, there are horror stories of these women and children being victims. So we make these connections through this monument building. And I think it's really empowering for women and for the victims, but also for the community and the local women, that we can raise our voice. Traditionally, this was a trauma and a stigma that victims were blamed and victims were forced to stay silent. But now this is the opportunity for the victims to raise their voice. The Comfort Women statues should appear in different nationalities, you know, not just a Korean girl wearing Korean costume, but also the Comfort Women can totally relate to anywhere. If there was war, there were women victims. It could be anybody. So I think these statues can, the girls can represent everybody.
The Comfort Woman movement has been enabled by the courage of survivors. In your perspective, how does recounting individual stories contribute to a deeper understanding of the issue? And why is storytelling crucial in addressing historical injustices like the Comfort Woman issue?
We tend to identify an incident with numbers, but these are all individual stories. And collectively, hundreds of thousands of women. And that's why it's more shocking that, okay, this kind of tragedy should not be repeated because I don't want the same story happen to me or my daughter or my aunt, my sister. So that's why these individual stories are so powerful. Everybody has their own story, and it's really important to listen to those stories.
Following up on the inspiring nature of the Comfort Woman movement, we see survivors like Harmony Lee Yong-soo turning into activists, actively pursuing resolutions such as bringing the Comfort Woman issue to the UN International Court of Justice. Could you elaborate on her journey and shed light on what actions we can and must take to support her and other initiatives moving forward?
Grandma Lee Yong-soo is truly an amazing person. Her courage and her fight really inspire a lot of people. And she, as the last campaign of her life, because she is 96 this year, she decided that, okay, I want to go to the International Court of Justice to get confirmation from the UN body that this was a government-led international human rights violation. The trick is that only state party can go to the International Court of Justice. Individual person cannot bring the issue to the ICJ. So she campaigned for 2 years to persuade the Korean government to do that. It has not responded because it put diplomatic relationship with Japan the priority over the Comfort Women victims. So Grandma Lee now is not continuing the campaign anymore because she knows that this government is not going to change its mind until government changes at some time. But we do have the online petitions that, you know, people can sign. But I really think it's more important to organize among student bodies to learn more about the Comfort Woman issue. Maybe invite Grandma Yong-soo Lee over Zoom to speak with the students. She would be happy to do that.
Once again, that was Phyllis Kim, who joined us for a discussion on the Comfort Woman issue. Our final guest today is Miki Dezaki, a graduate of the Graduate Program in Global Studies at Sophia University in Tokyo. After 5 years with the Japan Exchange Teaching Program and a transformative year as a Buddhist monk in Thailand, he's widely known as Medama Sensei on YouTube. Miki's directorial debut, Shuzenzo, the main battleground of the Comfort Woman issue, sheds light on the contentious debates surrounding Comfort Women, exploring hidden intentions and seeking answers to critical questions for both Japanese and Koreans. We're thrilled to have Miki with us, sharing insights from his unique journey and the making of this impactful documentary.
Thank you for being here. What inspired your decision to delve into this subject, and could you elaborate on the thought process behind your exploration?
Thank you for having me. I guess some context is needed or background. I was a Buddhist monk in Thailand before making this film. And I made the film actually in grad school. But in Thailand, I was meditating a lot and thinking about inner and outer peace. And eventually I left the monastery, but then joined grad school in Tokyo for global studies. And at that time, I was still in that mode of thinking of peace and how I can help contribute to bringing peace in the world. And especially Japan and Korea, they're allies, but they're kind of always at odds with each other. And I was wondering how I could contribute to peace between them and what is the most contentious or controversial issue between them. And it just happened to be the comfort woman issue. I have Korean friends and Japanese friends who know each other. And whenever they talk to each other, they can be friendly. But once they start talking about history, they get very heated and they start talking past each other because I think they both have different information pools where they're pulling from. So Japanese people get information from their media and Korean people get information from their media. And a lot of times information is not the same or things are left out conveniently. And so I thought if I made a film that kind of gave both sides of the issue and Korean and Japanese people both watch that film, then that would be a foundation from which they could have better discussions about the issue. And hopefully that could lead to some kind of reconciliation and peace between them. And I was very fortunate that this goal that I had is somewhat realized. I've been to a couple events that I was invited to where Japanese university students and Korean university students both watch the film together and then have dialogue about the comfort woman issue. And then, of course, they invite me to answer questions about the film. But that kind of thing really makes me happy just because that was really the goal. And hopefully many Japanese and Korean people will watch the film and have more dialogue about it, but we'll see.
That's really interesting. How has the documentary been received by audiences, and have there been any notable reactions or feedback that stood out to you?
So the film came out in theaters in Japan and South Korea. And in the US and Europe, I did university tours. I heard a lot of feedback. It's hard to pinpoint exactly what was the most interesting or whatever, but there are things that stood out to me. In Japan, of course, there were people who were angry and would threaten me and the theaters for showing the film. But overwhelmingly, the reaction was positive. I did get sued. It was a 4-year trial. They appealed all the way up to the Supreme Court, but I completely won the trial, which is great for me. Things that stuck out to me are I would have young Japanese students come up to me and say that they were totally shocked to learn about this issue because they didn't have any knowledge about it at all. They had no idea that the government was doing what they were doing. I think a lot of Japanese people just trust the government and what they say. And so if the Japanese government, which is very far right now, is saying that the Korean people are lying about this, then people just sort of believe it. Unfortunately, that creates more hatred against Koreans. It's a very subtle hatred. It's not like people are like writing signs, kill the Koreans or anything like that. But there's just an underlying bias against Koreans, I think, in Japan that is fostered by the government in a way and the media. I remember in particular, a young Japanese university student said to me that she had just completely believed everything that Prime Minister Abe was saying. And so she just assumed that the Koreans were purposely trying to aggravate and make Japan look bad. This is all just because they don't learn the history at all. And after they watched the film, they realized, oh, okay, there's a lot of things I didn't know. And a lot of times the students tell me that they have to watch it 2 or 3 times because it's so shocking to them. And it takes time for them to really absorb the information. I think this is what happens when you have a population of young people who really don't learn any of their history. So that's why people have a right to know this information. If they aren't taught it, they're believing in something that is just not true. And that belief can sort of affect how they view certain people. And in this case, with the comfort woman, I think it creates hatred against Koreans. Not only does it create hatred against Koreans, but it also creates distrust against women who speak out about rape and sexual violence. You can see how in Japan, the Me Too movement didn't really take off even though there were victims who, you know, came out with their stories of abuse, it didn't really take off because a lot of Japanese people just don't believe it. The stronger narrative is that women lie about these things. A lot of Japanese people want to know this stuff, right? And, you know, they don't want to be treating people like in Korea wrongly because they don't know about the issue, right? And so there's a lot of times there's embarrassment by Japanese people when they finally do learn about the comfort women issue. And I think that embarrassment comes from the fact that they realize, like, oh, I had thought so poorly about Korean people for so long because I had believed what the media was telling me. And so I'm like, shame. I feel ashamed that I was thinking that way when, you know, Koreans had a totally legitimate reason to be angry about something, right? And these victims have a totally legitimate reason to ask for justice.
Thank you. In the documentary, Koichi Nakano emphasizes that denying what happened is a second rape for this woman and causes more trauma. How does denial contribute to further suffering, and what role does societal shame play in perpetuating their pain?
It took these women a lot to overcome the patriarchal society that they live in that tells them that if they speak out, they will be seen as damaged or dirty. And then to be denied by people after speaking out is like getting punched a second time, the first punch being the crime of rape itself. So when their experience is not believed, it signals to these women that they have to suffer in silence. And it reminds them of the helplessness that they felt when they first were victimized. And what is worse is that some Japanese will take it a step further and call these women liars in the media or even at the United Nations. And so this sort of broadcasting of denial further compounds the pain. And if they do speak out, they're just called liars. So this is why I understand denying somebody's experience can be so painful, right? It's just continuing that pain. Personally, for myself, I experienced a lot of racism growing up as an Asian American in Florida, South Florida. In the US, racism against Asian Americans is not really talked about that much. You know, when I spoke out about it, a lot of times people didn't believe me, or they said, oh, it's not that bad. That kind of denial, it really hurts because, you know, you're trying to get people to really believe you, but they won't. Just because it's not in the mainstream narrative. The discrimination against, you know, Asians can sometimes be pretty bad in the sense that it's not systemic maybe, but on the personal level, if you're the minority of the minority in South Florida, there's not many Asian Americans. There's not many Japanese Americans, really. So, you know, I got racism from Hispanic kids, Black kids, white kids, right? If I spoke out about it, I couldn't really be recognized, or my suffering is not recognized. And so it's very tough to suffer in silence. And I really feel that. And maybe that's why I sort of resonate with this experience. I mean, of course, it's not on the same level, but I understand to some extent what it feels like for your suffering to be denied or your experience to be denied.
I can understand how painful that is. And it's really silencing your experiences and saying they're not important when it's being silenced by probably the person who did it, which makes it even more painful, in my opinion.
For sure, for sure. Because they control the narrative, right? They are the majority, and so they can control it. I made a video in the past about racism in Japan, a YouTube video, and I got in a lot of arguments with Japanese people, and a lot of Japanese people would tell me, oh, if we just don't talk about it, it won't be a problem, right? And it's just like, yeah, it's not a problem for you, but if you don't talk about it, then we, the minority, or whoever's, you know, suffering racism in Japan, will have to suffer in silence because they won't be able to speak out about what they're experiencing. So it allows the majority to be totally ignorant to the issue and therefore say, oh, there is no racism. And they can feel good about living their life in that society. But the people who live there who are suffering from racism and discrimination, they don't talk about it, then nobody knows about it.
And if no one talks about it and no one believes it, there's no way of addressing it.
Right. And then when you do speak out about it, it just seems like it's totally out of the blue. Like, where did you come out with this? You never talked about it before. And it's like, yeah, I couldn't talk about it before because I didn't feel like I had the space to talk about it. And then they're saying, why are you talking about it now? Why all of a sudden now? Do you have some kind of agenda? It's the same thing with the comfort women. The Japanese right-wing nationalists will say, well, why didn't they talk about it before? Why are they talking about it now? Well, back then in 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s Korea, can't talk about being used as a sexual slave because you'll just be totally seen as dirty and nobody will want anything to do with you. So it was only until the 90s when the women's rights movements and the feminist movements became stronger that these victims felt supported enough to be able to speak out. A lot of Japanese nationalists will just say, well, in the 90s, they just wanted money and they wanted to make Japan look bad. And that's why they started creating these stories and speaking out, right? So it's a very limited, narrow view, I think. And they don't care to widen their view, unfortunately.
Thank you. And thank you for sharing your experiences. I think it's important. In your documentary, you discussed the challenges associated with focusing on the number of women coerced into the comfort woman system. Could you elaborate on why you believe a focus on this number is problematic and how it impacts the understanding of the issue? Additionally, how does an emphasis on the number of victims contribute to or hinder the overall discourse surrounding the comfort woman issue?
This happens with Holocaust denial as well. Holocaust denialists will try to minimize the numbers to basically get them low enough to say, oh, this wasn't a genocide or this wasn't systemic mass murder. It was just an incident. And there are always incidents like this in the world. The Holocaust is no different, is what they want to say. This is also what happens with the comfort women issue. There was no exact accounting of how many women were used as comfort women. But there are estimates based off of documents. There are documents that said for every 30 soldiers, there was one comfort woman. Or sometimes they would find ones that say 50 soldiers to one comfort woman. So through that, they can sort of estimate how many comfort women there were. It is as low as 20,000, and it is as high as 400,000. Now, you can imagine that the Japanese right-wing nationalists want to use the lowest number, and the comfort women supporters want to use the highest number. Of these two, which is more problematic? I would say definitely the Japanese nationalists' use of the lower number, and the reason why I say it's more problematic is because it's used to deny the entire issue itself. The entire system of sexual slavery, they try to deny it by saying, oh, look how low this number is. It can't be a system of sexual slavery if it was this low. Whereas the comfort women supporters who say, well, it's 400,000 women, they're doing that to get support, garner support, and get sympathy, and say, hey, this horrible thing happened. We need this to be recognized. There was a very famous historian named Ikuhiko Hata, and he's a conservative historian. And in 1993, he estimated around 90,000, right? And he's a conservative historian. And then over the years, he reduced it to 20,000. And it's like, why did you reduce it? And it seems everybody believes that it is because of his political views. His political views make it 20,000. In the film, I show that even the most renowned historian, who actually the comfort women supporters agree with and like, whose name is Yoshimi Yoshiaki, he says around 60,000. And he says up to 200,000 possibly. 60,000 is him being conservative, and 200,000 is, you know, more of a sort of liberal take on it. But I think that we don't exactly know the numbers, and so they can be used in whatever way that people want to use them. And I think it often takes away from the experiences of the women, these women who are speaking about the suffering that they've went through. Meanwhile, the focus is on how many women were actually sex slaves. And oftentimes that discussion about the numbers is really a discussion of how can we totally discredit this whole thing. So I don't want to say that numbers are not important, because they are, but we have to be very careful about how we use these numbers. I believe that the Comfort Women supporters also have to be careful, because when they inflate the number too much, right, and if it's not, doesn't have a basis in some kind of historical fact, then they can be seen as doing the same thing as the right wingers are doing, Japanese nationalists. And that hurts their cause more than it helps the cause, I think. So I believe if you want to say a number, you can say a range. I think there is very good evidence to say that the number is estimated 60,000 to 200,000. People will use one number or the other to make it seem less or worse.
In your documentary, Yongsu Lee, a survivor, asked the Korean Ministry of Foreign Affairs if they want to kill this woman for a second time. In your own words, what does this mean? How does it reflect the gravity of the issue?
I took Ms. Lee saying that she was being killed a second time to mean that this agreement that Japan and Korea had made, that was made sort of behind their backs, was a denial of their justice, because they were seeking justice a certain way. And this agreement was totally ignoring what their demands were and just deciding that the former Comfort Women should take whatever they're willing to give. And so this denial of their justice, and it felt like the denial of their experience as well, I'm sure, because the Japanese government at the time, or even now, was very extremely right-wing and also trying to erase the history of the Comfort Women. And so this probably felt like second rape or second victimization to Ms. Lee and the victims. But of course, she said the agreement is killing them a second time instead of saying rape. So I think in her mind, she's saying that this was so serious, she didn't see it as just rape, but it was something that killed something inside of her. Maybe it was like an innocence or something. And denying her justice was like killing her again, probably reminding her of that experience of being helpless and hopeless. So that's how I saw it.
Thank you. When I heard her at the start, when she speaks, I can feel her pain. It's heartbreaking to see how upset she was. The Comfort Woman issue often elicits strong emotions. In your opinion, how can open dialogue contribute to a better understanding of historical injustices, and what steps can be taken toward resolution and reconciliation?
Open dialogue is important because in a society where the issue is taboo, like Japan, powerful politicians and influencers are able to slowly spread revisionist history through the media without much pushback. And so the narrative of these Korean women being liars in their testimonies starts to seem like common knowledge. And people don't really challenge what seems like common knowledge. I remember a young Japanese university student said after watching my film that it was the first time he had heard the Comfort Women supporting side's arguments. He had only heard the Japanese right-wing nationalist arguments on Twitter or YouTube. He just assumed that the Comfort Women had no logical arguments and only had the testimonies in Japanese mainstream media or mainstream narrative. The testimonies are considered lies. Therefore, the whole thing was a lie to this young student. And so So that's the danger of not hearing both sides of the issue and keeping it taboo. Young people don't get to hear both sides, and so they think, oh, if I don't hear the other side, then there must not be another side. Or the only side is this one thing, like the testimonies. And so they only have these testimonies, and so therefore it shows that their experience and their idea or narrative about the comfort women issue is totally false. Whereas what many Japanese people don't realize is that the overwhelming majority of Japanese historians know that the comfort women existed and agree that it was a system of sexual slavery. There are very few historians that say that it wasn't. And usually they are the fringe, super ultra nationalist right-wing historians. So what the Japanese population is getting is that very small minority of historians' view on this issue that really doesn't have a strong basis in fact. A lot of their historical narrative is based off of cherry-picked information taken out of context. And I didn't know that until I started making the film myself. Even though most historians agree that it was a system of sexual slavery, it's kind of difficult to understand this history because the Japanese right-wing nationalists are so good at sort of distributing or disseminating certain pieces of information, and those certain pieces of information make you think that, oh, wait, that must be a lie then, because they're totally taken out of context. And it was only until I started talking to actual historians who knew about these cherry-picked documents that the Japanese right-wingers were using and said, oh, that's not how you interpret that document at all. This document actually proves that the women were used as sexual slaves. So that's why it's very important, I think, to not just get all your information from Twitter or YouTube and actually read books and listen to experts who have been studying this their whole careers. Because a lot of these people who are disseminating the information about the comfort women issue in Japan are actually not even historians. They call themselves historians, but they're not historians.
Once again, that was Miki Dezaki, who joined us for a discussion on the comfort women issue. You have been listening to Beyond the Headlines on CIUT 89.5 FM. That wraps up our show for this week. We were joined today by Uhi Kim, Phyllis Kim, and Miki Dezaki. Many thanks to our guests for coming onto the show to talk about the silenced history of the comfort women system during World War II, delving into the experiences of the survivors, the ongoing fight for awareness and justice, and the importance of informed discourse to achieve resolution and reconciliation. Today's show was produced by myself, Yunji Huang, alongside my co-producer, Elena Viabona Paromero. If you liked today's episode, please like and review us wherever you're listening. The views expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of the producers, CIUT, or the Hmong School of Global Affairs and Public Policy. If you missed any part of the show, be sure to check out podcasts of all our episodes on our website at www.beyondtheheadlines.net, as well as on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. If you're a fan of our show or want to stay up to date with policy issues in Canada or the global current affairs, follow us on Twitter at beyond_headlines. You can also check us out on Facebook or Instagram. Be sure to tune in next week as we continue to take public policy and global affairs discussions out of the hallways and onto the airwaves.